Stanford for this happening? Why are, you know, actually in the last 10 years has there not even been, I think there's only been one expulsion at Stanford for any of the assaults of all the numbers that you just said were happening. So, you know, there is this kind of real unwillingness we're seeing still, which I'm hoping that this letter will now shift and this will be a change and everyone will say, you know, we need to do better. We need to protect our students better. But I also want to go back and say two things about that long
piece. Very quickly, we have 20 seconds.
Okay. Read by this, the law professors. There's not one factual error in our film. There actually was textual evidence that he had assaulted Camila. And so, you know, their letter is rife with errors, and please go to our website and we can explain how that is. But, it, you know, it's just unconscionable that they use their platform to critique someone in this way.
We're going to do part two of this conversation and post online at democracynow.org. Amy Ziering, the filmmaker behind The Hunting Ground, and Camila Willingham, student at Harvard Law School when she and friend were sexually assaulted by an acquaintance. That does it for the show. I'll be speaking June 11th, Saturday, in Chicago at Jones College Prep. Thanks for joining us. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez.
It's 5 o'clock p.m. You are listening to KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM, and the evening news is next.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud sponsor of the 16th Annual Village Building Convergence, June 3rd to June 12th, to take place in locations all over Portland. The Village Building Convergence is an annual celebration of placemaking, community, natural building, music, and art. During the daytime, there will be 35 natural building and public arts projects to take part in. During the evening, there will be food, speakers, musical performances, and more. Again, that's the 16th Annual Village Building Convergence, June 3rd to June 12th in Portland. Information on project locations, performances, speakers, and more can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
Lanita Duke is back on the air, so join me at listener-supported KBOO Community Radio on Sunday, June 12th from 8 p.m. until 10, as we celebrate the music of Miss Roberta Flack while analyzing the 2016 Portland City Council race. Sunday night, June 12th from 8 p.m. until 10 on community-supported KBOO.
This KBOO program has been made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from The Art of Living, presenting Get Happy Portland, a two-day immersive experience of breathing techniques and meditation by global humanitarian Sri Sri Ravishankar. Get Happy Portland takes place July 5th and 6th at the Oregon Convention Center. Tickets and information are available at gethappyportland.org.
KBOO Community.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, police are reportedly blocking the Golden Rule Peace Boat as it sails through downtown Portland.
The Yakima Nation held a press conference in Mosier with Robert F. Kennedy Jr. in order to oppose fossil fuel trains.
And we'll have an in-depth discussion with environmental attorney Brent Foster, who lives in Mosier, about the role of the Union Pacific Railroad and oil shipments through the area.
Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Thursday, June 9th, 2016. I'm Robert Barncord.
And I'm Jenny Yokoyama. It's Fleet Week in Portland, which is normally associated with massive warships moving through downtown Portland and docking for the annual Rose Festival. This year, however, they were joined by a sailing ship bearing a huge peace sign on one of its sails. This is the Golden Rule Peace Boat, which sailed to the Marshall Islands in 1958 to protest atmospheric nuclear weapon testing. It's a central symbol of the anti-nuke and wider peace movements and was rehabilitated by the group Veterans for Peace for this year's expedition. However, this afternoon, the peace boat was detained on the river in downtown Portland. KBOO reporters Emery Mort and Natasha Delapine filed this report from the scene.
When the steel bridge was raised to let in the Navy warship, the Golden Rule was surrounded by what looked to be about 8 boats, from Coast Guard to firefighters, et cetera. And the fireboat actually opened up a water cannon spraying at the Golden Rule. And eventually the Golden Rule then was pushed over towards the Esplanade on the east side, and authorities even boarded the boat. And also communications were cut off.
Has there been any indication from the police or fire or the Coast Guard why they're doing this?
I'm not totally sure why they did this. I have heard that there was a safe zone or a security zone. And
they boarded all ships within the security zone.
Okay, so I'm getting word from Natasha here that all ships that were within the security zone were boarded, and the Golden Rule was one of those ships. And at this time, the Golden Rule is moving freely within their lane, which appears to be on the east side of the river.
Okay, and that's also KBOO reporter Natasha Delapine in the background. You said you were in contact with people on the boat?
Yes, we spoke with 2 people on the boat, one Mimi German and another Helen Jacquard, who is the project manager of Golden Rule Veterans for Peace.
And how are they doing?
Well, Mimi says that they're doing good. Both seem to be in fine spirits.
They were well out of the way of the water.
That was sprayed at them. And they seem to be moving fine now. And they say that when their boat was boarded, that the people who boarded it made a joke that they needed to make sure that there were no nukes on board.
Uh-huh. Anything else that our listeners should know about this incident?
Well, the people on board want to say that the Golden Rule boat is attempting to glorify the cause of peace, in contrast to the warships that are coming in to Portland that are glorifying the cause of war.
I'm Sam Bowman, speaking with KBOO reporters Emery Mort and Natasha Delapine, who are down in northwest Portland at the waterfront, where the Golden Dragon peace boat of the Veterans for Peace has been detained and apparently let go by Portland and Coast Guard authorities.
The June Barkabout Hike will take place this Sunday, June 12th. Lorianne Bird will lead the hike to explore a road which has been rewilded in the Salmon Huckleberry Wilderness. Lorianne spoke to KBOO about the objectives of the BARC organization and the details of this Sunday's hike.
I'm Bird. I'm a volunteer with BARC and formerly BARC's Restore Mount Hood campaign manager and staff attorney. A barkabout happens once a month, the second Sunday of every month. The Salmon River Road that we're going to be walking on, it follows Salmon River. The Salmon River is extremely important habitat for endangered coho and Chinook salmon. So this is an incredibly important area. It's also a little keyhole into the Salmon Huckleberry Wilderness, so that means that there's wilderness on all sides of the road, but the road itself was excluded from the original wilderness designation. So Mount Hood staff, the National Forest Service staff, recognized that this road was a huge problem. It was allowing all these motorized vehicles access into this keyhole. There's a huge problem with illegal dumping of trash at the very end of the road. A lot of people would go there and dump their TVs. So BARC is an organization that really relies on grassroots power and really relies on raising awareness of what's going on in Mount Hood and bringing the public's attention to what's going on in order to shift how Mount Hood is managed. So if we weren't doing all this work, we wouldn't be making some of the incredible progress that we've made on Mount Hood. Mount Hood has over 3,000 miles of roads on it. It's a massive, massive road network. It was mostly built for logging purposes back in the day, and some of it is still used for logging, but a lot of those roads are crumbling, and Mount Hood's roads are the number one threat to watershed health in Mount Hood National Forest. And so by getting people out on the ground to look at this, you can actually see what it looks like when a road is returned, is decommissioned, and, you know, it starts becoming a wild trail and then eventually just wild forest again. This isn't, you know, a rigorous big hike, but it is a hike on a decommissioned road, and so they should expect to walk on uneven terrain. That could be a little bit tricky in parts. They should have the patience for a group hike. So, you know, sometimes people show up and want to do a big hike, but this is a group hike, and it's geared towards all levels. So, you know, you need to have some ability to be comfortable in the woods. Folks should meet at Trader Joe's, in the Hollywood Trader Joe's, 4121 Northeast Halsey in the parking lot. That's where we meet up at 9 a.m. sharp. And you don't need a car. We, you know, encourage people who have cars to bring their cars so that we can get everyone out in the woods. But if you don't have a car, hopefully you can get a ride with someone else. But please do bring gas money if that's the case. And if you are hoping to drive, please go on BARC's website under the events and look at the expectations for drivers so you can make sure that you meet those expectations.
Interested hikers are reminded to bring lunch, water, and whatever else they feel need in order to feel comfortable for a day in the forest. This month's hike is both kid and dog friendly. Additional information can be found at the BARC website, www.bark-out.org.
Portland will not be included in this year's FBI's crime statistics report this year due to a faulty computer system. The FBI compiles data from every metropolitan center in the country in order to update its crime statistics and display national trends. A $12.6 million computer system used to store local crime data was unable to send in the report. This is the second year in a row that the software has failed to send the reports, and Portland has effectively been left out of any kind of national trend research. The new software was brought in for easier informational sharing amongst officers from different jurisdictions and to replace the aging equipment that was being used beforehand. Portland and other areas using the new software have until February to fix the problem if they want their statistics in the annual FBI report.
Firefighters report that Oregon's first major wildfire has been 90% contained. The Owyhee Canyon blaze has burned 23,000 acres in southeast Oregon's Malheur County. This is amidst the recent heat wave and the higher winds. Incident commander Sam DeLong credited the Vail Hotshot crew with stopping the fire before it jumped across a river. At its peak, the fire came within a mile and a half of the town of Rome, Oregon. Warm conditions and increased lightning strikes have fire crews monitoring several wildfires statewide, hoping that the approaching cooler weather will aid their efforts. For the fire season, land managers urge campers and other visitors to contact land management organizations to inquire whether open fires are being permitted. Members of the Portland Central American Solidarity Committee this week gained entrance to the General Motors shareholder meeting. Their goal was to draw attention to human rights abuses at General Motors factory in Bogota, Colombia, which they did. KBOO's Lisa Loving spoke Monday afternoon with Paige Shell Spurling about what happened. We have an abridged version of that, but tune in to KBOO next week to hear the full extended interview and PSASC's plan to bicycle across the country to the homes of the GM shareholders.
We're all really excited because this is the first time that we've been able to get the CEO really on record claiming that, you know, the plant is safe, claiming that the workers were unreasonable, you know, and we really, it was just amazing that she was saying as much as she was because, you know, there's a lot of evidence to refute what she was saying. So basically, there's a group of injured workers that were dismissed from their jobs on the assembly line of General Motors in Bogota, Colombia, after becoming injured on the job. They were dismissed because of those injuries, although GM claims it was for other reasons. These workers have been resisting. They've been in a tent encampment in front of the U.S. Embassy on the street in Bogota, Colombia, for the last 4.5 years, almost 5 years now. And they've gone through a series of hunger strikes, stitching their lips closed with needle and thread, and burial actions and symbolic crucifixions. So today was the stockholder meeting of General Motors, and I traveled from Portland. I'm with the Portland Central America Solidarity Committee. I traveled to Detroit and actually bought a share of stock so that I could attend the meeting, and went in there and asked the CEO about the situation.
So for people in the United States who might be listening to this broadcast, how are they impacted by this issue?
Definitely impacted, because what's going on right now is a race to the bottom. All of the working conditions of U.S. workers are being brought down by this supposed competition with workers in other countries. So the way that that plays out in this situation is that there are U.S. auto workers that are being told that they have to accept concessions. And the reasoning that the company's given is basically just so that they'll be competitive with workers in other parts of the world. Well, which workers are they being competitive with? It's workers like these workers that are exploited, that are working long hours in unsafe conditions for low wages with few regulations. And so if the workers in the United States are being told that they have to be competitive, what they need to do, the way they need to react, is by standing in solidarity with the people that are in other countries, the workers that are trying to raise those conditions and bring it all up.
Last week's oil train explosion in this small town of Mosier woke up many people in our region about the dangers of fuel shipments across the regional landscape. It's also shined a light on this national scenic area. The Friends of the Columbia Gorge are among the grassroots organizations mobilizing on this issue. Here to talk about Mosier and to talk about their project, Gorge Town to Trails, is Friends of the Gorge Executive Director Kevin Gorman. Thank you so much for coming in, Kevin.
You're welcome.
So I actually called you in for an interview today because when I was researching about this oil train explosion here in the newsroom, we were all sort of zooming in on, you know, internet maps of the town and noticed there's actually some hiking trails that went through the town, and was really excited to find out that there is this project being done by Friends of the Columbia Gorge called Gorge Town to Trails. Why don't you tell us a little bit about this idea?
Well, let me start out talking. Everyone's heard about Mosier in the news lately, and it's awful what's happened to them, but this is a very resilient community. This is a community I fell in love with 20 years ago, and they are shaping their vision. And one of the ways they embraced the National Scenic Area Act, I'd say, before any other gorge community, and they saw the advantage of protected lands around them, and they saw the advantage of hiking trails, and the idea of not just having trails that people come out for a day hike and drive home, but really a long distance trail where eventually you could wrap around the gorge and you could go from town to town, similar to the way you see in Europe, and where people could hike from one place to another without their cars, leave their cars in Portland or whatever, and not only experience the lands, but experience the best that the gorge has to eat, to drink, and to stay overnight and really appreciate those communities. That's the concept between our Gorge Towns to Trails vision. And Mosier was the first community that really said, we want to be part of that. So what we did with that community, I really hope that everybody, once all the government officials are gone and all that stuff, you will go out and visit this community, because it's a wonderful place. In a couple weeks, all their cherries will be in. And but within the community is a small park that they created. It could have been beautiful homes looking over the river, and instead they created a park, and it ends at this waterfall. Well, we worked with the community to take their park and take their trail and extend it further and eventually go up to our land trust property that sits right above the town. So this is our first segment of a Gorge Towns to Trails property, and it basically starts in Mosier, goes through their city park, and ends up on top of our property. And it really offers a wonderful view. And right down below it are a couple of wineries, and they're interested in connecting from our trail to their wineries and creating a loop trail system. Our long-term goal is to get to the Dalles, and we're looking at a stretch from Hood River to the Dalles that's 20 miles long, and there's only a mile of trail that really needs to happen. The rest of it is all public land. It's already there. We just need to build it.
So the eventual kind of vision for this trail is that you said it will wrap around the gorge. How many miles do you guys envisioning this final trail being?
Well, the gorge is about 83 miles long. So, you know, we think it's probably going to be anywhere from, you know, 180 to 200 miles when you go back and forth. And in some cases, we already have trail systems, like in the whole waterfall area. We have the historic highway between Mosier and Hood River that's closed to cars. And so what we're doing is we're concentrating on some key areas where we feel like over the next 15 years, we can really make a difference. And one is Hood River to the Dalles. Another is Washougal to Stevenson. In each of those cases, you have corridors that are already 90%, 95% connected publicly. And we're trying to find those last pieces of land that we can purchase to make those connections happen and then work with the agencies, the U.S. Forest Service, the state parks, to make it all happen. So,
well, as we've been hearing interviews from the mayor of Mosier and from Hood River, one of the things that they say about these train lines and these crude train oil trains going through their towns is how they don't really economically benefit from these trains going through. There's not even train stations in their town. But when I was speaking to the mayor of Mosier, she was the one who actually brought this trail up and was saying, this is very exciting for us because it'll bring people to the area.
Yeah. Yeah. And I was fortunate enough 16 years ago to hire her as a gorge organizer. And she's a rafting guide and she's found her footing as the mayor of Mosier. She's doing an amazing job. But, you know, it struck me about these train lines because just a few days ago was the 100th anniversary of the historic highway. They did the celebration at Multnomah Falls. And I looked at the picture from June 7th, 1916. And you had all these people at Multnomah Falls, and the highway wasn't built yet. So then the question was, how did they get there? They took a train. There was train travel from Portland out to Multnomah Falls, to Hood River, et cetera, and people traveled by the train. We can't do that now because it's loaded with coal, it's loaded with oil, and we've lost something that we had 100 years ago, because wouldn't it be wonderful if people could get on a train and go visit these wonderful places in the gorge and not have to take their cars? We're seeing the transportation problems that are already happening, and we gave up one of the wonderful attributes we had 100 years ago.
Well, maybe people won't be able to take a train out right now, but possibly they'll be able to walk there along this.
Yes.
You know, if people still right now, even though this trail has not been finished and it's just pretty much in pieces right now, that doesn't mean that people can't hike parts of the gorge. Maybe you want to talk a little bit about the book that is listed there on your website.
Oh, yeah. So this is a member of ours, a wonderful woman, Laura Foster, that just wrote a book about gorge getaways, and it's 12 weekend getaways from towns to trails. And so, again, the concept is we have a lot of great places to go hike in the gorge, but there's a lot of great attributes beyond the hikes. There's a lot of great things in the towns. And what I really would like to encourage listeners is, I think when people, you know, you have people from out of town or whatever, quite often you go to Multnomah Falls, or you go to Eagle Creek, or you go to Dog Mountain, and these places are being loved to death. And, you know, there are a number of wonderful places throughout the gorge that people have never seen. You know, waterfalls they've never discovered, swimming holes, etc. And I think if just, you know, if people go to our website, and it's www.gorgefriends.org, we have a hike finder of over 100 hikes, and people can type in whether they want easy, moderate, hard. They can type in the distance, whether it's dog friendly, etc. And they can find all these assortment of hikes that they may have never heard about. So And Laura's book also has a lot of those. So I encourage people to kind of, so most people think they know the gorge, and I guess I would encourage people to, and I guess I really encourage Laura a little deeper. I think you'll really find some places a little deeper outside the waterfall areas, outside the waterfall gorge that are wonderful. You'll get a lot out of, and by all means, you'll get a lot out there. Patronize those towns because they need the support, particularly Mosher. I mean, they've just been hit hard and they need our support.
Well, it seems like something pretty tempting for people from Portland, especially to if they want a different way to explore the gorge. And, you know, when we tend to think of the gorge, we tend to think of the Pacific Crest Trail as the very well-known trail that goes through the wilderness out there. Well, maybe this will create some temptation for people when you say, hey, you can hike from a vineyard to another vineyard.
Yeah, we call it wiking because it's wine and hiking. And when we have...
I've not heard of that one.
Yes.
I've heard of glamping, so now you can glamp and wike.
Yeah, so we do wiking and then we do trails to ales. So I think we've hit on something because those seem to be the most popular hikes these days.
We're just out of time. Thank you so much. That is Kevin Gorman coming in here live in Studio 2 from Friends of the Columbia Gorge. You can check out more at www.gorgefriends.org. Go have a hike, everyone, and check out what's up in Mosher besides this horrible train crash, because there is a lot to offer out in these small towns. Thank you for joining us today.
Thank you.
The race to be the Democratic nominee for president seemed to reach a conclusion for many voters today. KB reporter John Pacheco has more.
President Obama announced his endorsement for the presumptive Democratic nominee Hillary Clinton today. The endorsement was announced in a video posted on the Clinton campaign Facebook page. President Barack Obama stated she's fully qualified for the presidency and has the courage, compassion, and the heart to get the job done. 8 years ago, Clinton and Obama served as senators and competed for the presidency in 2008. She would eventually serve in Barack Obama's cabinet as Secretary of State from 2009 to 2013. She was succeeded by John Kerry after she resigned in the midst of the Benghazi hearings. This week, the president thanked Senator Bernie Sanders for firing up young voters, shining light on issues like income inequality and money in politics. Sanders met with the president this morning in the Oval Office, where he thanked the president and vice president for remaining neutral during the primary process. In a statement to the press, Bernie Sanders vowed to work with the Democrats at Clinton campaign to defeat Donald Trump in November. He has yet to concede or endorse Hillary Clinton and vows to continue to the convention. President Obama then finished up his endorsement with a call for unity to the Democratic Party. He said it's been a hard-fought campaign and compared it to the 2008 campaign. Current polls show Trump and Clinton are neck to neck. A recent Quinnipiac poll shows Clinton beating Trump by 4 points, while an ABC News Washington Post poll shows Trump beating Hillary by 2 points. For the KB News, I'm John Pacheco.
And in California, there was a huge surge in new voter registration leading up to this year's primaries. But at least one analyst reports that the young voters might not have come through when it counted. According to Paul Mitchell of Political Data Incorporated, voters under 35 now make up one-fourth of California's voters, but these young voters only accounted for about 10% of the ballots that were mailed early to the election boards. In contrast, early mail-in ballots from voters over the age of 55 made up 68% of the vote tally. The LA Times estimated that 5 million votes would be cast via mail in the state of California. Results show presumptive Democratic presidential candidate Hillary Clinton outpaced Senator Bernie Sanders by about 500,000 votes. Nationwide, Sanders held a large advantage over Clinton among young voters, while Clinton tended to hold the advantage among older voters. Sanders' odds of winning the national election, Sanders' odds of winning were slim heading into Tuesday's primaries. He had been counting on winning the nation's most populous state to add a feather in his cap heading toward the Democratic Party convention, which is coming up in July.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned for an in-depth interview with environmental attorney Brent Foster at 5:45, followed by Rose City Native Radio at 6. At 7, it's Hard Knock Radio, news and views from a hip-hop perspective. Tomorrow's weather will be cloudy with a high of 65 and a low of 50, with an 80% chance of rain and possible thunderstorms in the afternoon. Today in history, in 1967, the Israeli army captured the Golan Heights from Syria during the Six-Day War. And in 1972, heavy rainfall in the Black Hills region of South Dakota caused a dam failure on Rapid Creek, flooding Rapid City, killing 238 people. And in 1999, the Kumanova Treaty was signed between the Federal Republic of Yugoslavia and NATO, ending the Kosovo War, though hostilities continued for two more days. The quote of the day is from Joseph Welch, attorney for the U.S. Army, who on this day in 1954 lashed out at communist hunting Senator Joseph McCarthy. He said, "You've done enough. Have you no sense of decency, sir, at long last? Have you left no sense of decency?"
The trial against the police officer involved in the death of Freddie Gray started today. Officer Cesar Goodson is being charged with multiple convictions, which include second-degree murder, manslaughter, and misconduct. The incident began on April 12, 2015, when Officer Goodson failed to secure Freddie Gray with a seatbelt in the back of a police van while en route to the police station. Freddie Gray suffered from a spinal injury from this incident and died a week later. This event eventually sparked the Black Lives Matter protests in Baltimore, which left the city in chaos and led to the dismissal of police chief Anthony Batts. Goodson declined a jury trial, and his fate will be determined by the presiding judge, Barry Williams.
The United States Attorney for the Southern District of New York has announced the arrest of Norman Seabrook, the president of the Correction Officers Benevolent Association, and Murray Huberfield, founder of Platinum Partners, a New York-based investment firm. Seabrook was investing money from the union's retirement fund to Platinum Partners for kickbacks worth up to $100,000 to $150,000 per year, according to allegations from an anonymous witness. COBA is the biggest municipal jail workers union in the United States, with 9,000 members in the organization. Both men face two federal charges that could total 20 years in prison on each charge.
Israel has large-scale development plans intended to attract new populations to the Negev Desert and turn its southern peripheral region into a military and technology hub. Indigenous Bedouins in the area say the ambitious designs do not take their needs into consideration and will only deepen the historical mistrust between the Israeli government and its Arab-Palestinian minority. Reporter Sylvia Borini visited Al-Haran and Atir, which are two unrecognized Bedouin villages facing the threat of demolition, and she filed this report.
It's mid-afternoon in Al-Haran, a quaint Bedouin village nestled on the rolling hills of the Negev in southern Israel. Local resident Tasnim Abu Alkian points to stands of olive trees, to jerry cans used to hold water, and to solar panels that generate electricity for the village. Established in its current location by military order in 1956, after the army forcibly displaced the semi-nomadic tribe from their ancestral lands, Al-Haran has never been recognized by Israel as a legal settlement and still doesn't receive any basic services such as water or electricity through the grid. 12-year-old Tasnim Abu Alkian has lived here all her life, but she knows her future is uncertain.
Here we have trees, cars, homes, land. All these things are here because we need them, and they can't just be destroyed. We don't want to leave the village, and I don't know why they want us to leave. I can't understand.
Human rights organizations working in the Negev believe the eviction of the 1,100 Bedouin residents of Al-Haran and neighboring Atir is strictly linked to multi-billion dollar development plans that Israel is implementing in the area. Suhad Bishara is an attorney with the Haifa-based Legal Center for Arab Minority Rights, Adala.
Usually when the Israeli authorities speak about development plans, they speak about bringing Jewish communities to the Naqab. It's usually maneuvered to meeting the interests of the state of Israel to maintain segregation. When we read or look at these development plans, we try to analyze from this perspective how it will affect What are the interests behind this plan?
Umm al-Hiran and Attir are two of 35 villages in the Negev without official recognition from Tel Aviv. They are home to 70,000 Bedouins and often predate the State of Israel. In 2011, in an attempt to regularize Bedouin settlement, the government adopted the Praver Plan, which proposed to demolish all 35 villages and transfer the population to existing townships and recognized settlements. In 2013, following widespread outcry, the plan was supposedly shelved, but activists say it is moving forward in practice. In May of last year, after a 14-year-long legal battle, Israel's Supreme Court ruled that the state can demolish the villages of Umm al-Hiran and Attir, build a Jewish settlement and plant a forest on top of them, and displace their 1,100 inhabitants to nearby Hura, one of seven townships planned by the government since the 60s to urbanize the Bedouins. Suhad Bishara's organization Adala represented the villages in court.
The case of Umm al-Hiran and Attir proves that the state perceives the Bedouin citizens as a problem that needs to be solved within the interest of the Jewish state to Jewidize the Naqab. Thus, the inhabitants of Umm al-Hiran and Attir simply become objects that can be moved or should be moved according to the state policy.
The Bedouin community and Jewish and international activists working with them believe the only sensible solution is to recognize the villages. Chaya Noach, executive director of the Arab-Jewish human rights NGO Negev Coexistence Forum, does not accept the state's explanation that providing infrastructure to unrecognized Bedouin villages is too costly.
The government just decided about five new Jewish villages, two of them on top of Bedouin villages. So the problem is not too much infrastructures and budgets, because those budgets are available. More than this, they don't have to found the villages. The villages are there. People are living there. The government just doesn't want Arabs to live in small rural villages, which seems to be a privilege of the Jewish community in Israel.
Back in Umm al-Hiran, Tasneem has no doubt that the state is making a big mistake.
If I were the president, I would not discriminate against the Jews just because of their religion or against the Muslims. I would put everyone on the same scale. What we deserve, they deserve the same. We have to be equal so there won't be problems that lead to conflict and destruction.
Near Tasneem's home, Jewish National Fund bulldozers have already begun preparing the land for tree planting. No one in Umm al-Hiran nor Attir knows when the eviction will take place, but they vow to continue fighting to win recognition for their village and their rights as citizens. Silvia Borini, FSRN, Umm al-Hiran.
The Yakima Nation and other Columbia River tribes held a press conference in Mosher today at the Mosher Community School in the Columbia River Gorge. At the site near the derailment of Friday's oil train, environmental activist Robert Kennedy Jr. flew in to speak as well. Cable reporter Theo Burke was on the scene.
Native American language, prayers, and speeches from the Yakima Nation and affiliated Columbia River tribes were the featured thing today at a press conference in Mosier, along with an appearance by Robert F. Kennedy Jr., environmental activist, who flew out for this press conference in Mosier, Oregon, and who has a niece who lives in Mosier. KBOO Radio was out at the press conference, and our report tonight first features two speakers from the press conference itself, Jode Gowdy, the chairman of the Yakima Nation, and Robert F. Kennedy Jr.
This event that has occurred here today has been referenced at times as to dodging of a bullet, but there's consequences that have been endured by what has happened here. There's consequences to this town of Mosier, to its residents, to their well-being, their livelihood. There's consequence to the natural resources that have been involved, the Enchiwana, also known as the Columbia River. Yakima Nation, along with other Columbia River Treaty tribes, Warm Springs Nez Perce Nation, Nez Perce Nation, all have historical ties to our Enchiwana, to the Columbia River.
Chairman Gowdy spoke to the amount of people that benefit from the fossil fuel industry versus the amount of the people affected, for instance, in the Columbia Gorge.
How many people truly are part of those corporations? How many people are truly employed? What type of benefit is coming directly to their families, to their homes, and to their children's? How many shareholders are part of these various corporations who are involved with regard to this transport of fossil fuels? Who is all involved in that situation? Who truly is reaping the economic gain? And as we've always stated, we believe that to be a very small percentage when it comes to the impact that's felt by everyone with regard to events like happened the other day. Yakima Nation's stance with regard to fossil fuels, oil, coal, and the other fuels that are out there has been zero tolerance. We do not want fossil fuels at all coming through the Columbia River Gorge at all.
And now Robert F. Kennedy Jr., who spoke to how the technological improvements for moving oil trains through the gorge ordered by the Federal Department of Transportation still led to this accident, how the benefits of the oil are going overseas, and how alternative fuels are not only cleaner but cheaper than all other fossil fuel and nuclear alternatives.
And it's in this particular little stretch of rail is in perfect condition. It could not be in better condition. And they said, well, we got them to reduce the amount of flammable gases in Bakken crude because, as you all know, Bakken crude is the most flammable kind and explosive kind of crude oil. It's more explosive, more flammable than raw gasoline. These are anybody who says this is not a bomb train. The DOT says we can expect 12 derailments a year of Bakken crude oil trains. And it's going to create a renaissance of manufacturing in this country, a rebirth of manufacturing, because energy prices are going to be so low that everybody is going to suddenly build factories. Well, now they're building a terminal so the Chinese can be paying the same amount for natural gas as we're paying. There is no benefit. It is a harm to the United States. But unfortunately, as all these projects show, we have lawmaking and government that is not being run for irrational reasons or for public safety reasons. It is being run. Rules are being written by the carbon incumbents to favor and support the filthiest, dirtiest, most addictive, most destructive fuels from hell rather than the cheap, clean, green, wholesome, and patriotic fuels from heaven, which we have plenty of in this country. And this is just another externality of big oil. You know, oil, there's no way that oil could compete with renewable energy in this country if it had to do it head to head. So it has to get hundreds of billions of dollars of subsidies every year, and it has to externalize the cost of doing business. And part of those externalities are what they did here, which is to make a fire and disrupt this community and put everybody in this community at risk. And that's the only way that they can compete in the marketplace. And what they're and they know that now because, and I'll tell you, I am in the solar energy business. I do construction of solar energy plants and wind energy plants. And I can tell you, we built the two biggest solar energy plants in this country. And I can tell you the price of building solar energy is about $2.5 billion per gigawatt. Well, what's the price of a natural gas plant? $3 billion a gigawatt. Oil plant, $3 billion a gigawatt. A coal plant, $3 billion a gigawatt. A nuke plant, $15 billion a gigawatt. You could make energy by burning prime rib if you wanted to. Why would we use the most expensive kind? The only reason we use the most expensive kind is because they have subverted our democracy and they are running the show.
I'm Theo Burke from the Columbia River Gorge in still beautiful Mosier for the KBOO Evening News.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News. This is a volunteer-produced newscast. We encourage your participation. Call us with your breaking news stories at 503-231-8032, extension 203. Our production team for tonight's newscast is Devlet Bedula, Theo Burke, Natasha Delapine, Emery Mort, John Pacheco, and Sam Talner. The producer is Sam Bowman.
Special thanks to our friends at Free Speech Radio News, found at fsrn.org. Our engineer is Pooh Epstein, and the KABU Evening News and Public Affairs Director is Lisa Loving. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You can also find us on Facebook and Twitter at KABU News. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Robert Barncourt.
And I'm Jenny Yokoyama. Coming up tomorrow morning at 7, it's Democracy Now! With Amy Goodman and Juan Gonzalez. At 8 on Positively Revolting, join Ani and Lynn as they look at rape culture through the lens of the recent sentencing of Stanford student Brock Turner, who received 6-month sentence after being found guilty of 3 counts of felony sexual assault. At 9 on Progressive Spirit, host John Shuck speaks with Dr. Nadia Gordon, a Palestinian-American who wrote the book Palestine is Our Home, Voices of Loss, Courage, and Steadfastness. At 9:30, we speak with Matthew Charles Cardinal, a Portland-based housing advocate, about an ordinance for affordable housing impact statements that he has presented to Multnomah County. At 10, Chris Andre hosts Air Cascadia. At 10:15, it's Flashpoints with Dennis Bernstein. And 11, on the Digital Divide, we hear an extended statement from Chelsea Manning. Thanks, KABU members, for your generous support. Not a KABU member? You can become one by going to kboo.fm and clicking on Donate Today. Good night, Robert.
Good night, Jenna. Yesterday, environmental attorney Brent Foster spoke with KABU News about conditions on the railroad track at Mosier, where the oil train derailed, ignited, and then exploded, following the pattern of Bakken oil trains derailing, igniting, and then exploding. Foster talked about how Union Pacific workers cut up a section of the track and carried it away, then reinstalled a new section in a very short period of time without any investigation being done. This was despite the city of Mosier and other local officials' request that the scene be investigated by local authorities to see what caused the explosion. Tonight, we're airing the extended interview.
Well, right now, actually, in the last half hour, somewhat shockingly, they've literally cut up a section of railroad track and are laying a new section of railroad